Hello and welcome to the podcast for episode 211, Vengeance is Mine. I'm Ronald D. Moore, executive producer and developer of the Outlander television series, and I'm joined by our very special guests, and today, none other than Diana Gabaldon.
Why, thank you.
Welcome, Diana. Well, this was a very special episode in many ways. This was Diana's first script for us.
Yes.
So let's just start there. Season one, I remember before we... before we ever shot the show, when I came to visit you in Scottsdale, and we talked about adaptation and the process of it, which was a really great first meeting.
Yeah, enjoyed that very much.
And I remember at that point, I think I said, you know, if you ever feel like you want to write one, we should talk, and it would be great to have you do it. And what made you decide to finally want to do it?
Well, it was partly seeing how the process worked, because when we talked, I had never even seen a script, let alone have any idea as to who actually did what process it went through. And also at the time, I was moving into the final frenzy of a novel. There was no way I could set that down and in order to write a script or learn how to write a script. But as the season went on, you guys started showing me the outlines and the revised outlines and the scripts and the script revisions and revisions and revisions and revisions. I realized that this was a very iterative, collective kind of process. And also you began to tell me the notes that went back and forth and what you saw. And so I could see that this was not a one-man job like writing a novel is. It's a little more collective. In other words, I would not just be hung out to dry. I would have kind of the support, so to speak, of the writer's room and yourself and so forth, which was encouraging. Still, I might not have done it because I didn't want to, you know, seem to be pushing in or depriving one of your writers of an episode that they wanted. But at Paley Fest, year ago, year and a half, Ann Kenny, just as we were leaving, I stopped to say goodbye to her, and she said, you know, if you'd ever like to write a script, I'd be happy to write one with you. And I said, really? Anyway, I wasn't sure if I'd actually heard her write, so I emailed her a couple of weeks later and said, I think this is what you said. Was I hallucinating? If I wasn't, do you still mean it? And she said, no, you weren't hallucinating. Yes, I meant it. I said, oh, well, in that case, yeah, I would kind of like to, I think, you know. And anyway, one thing happened, and then another, and anyway, I ended up with a script of my very own, which was kind of nice. I mean, as very own as a script gets in this business, is a good long way from writing a novel. That might be one thing we should make clear to the fans, because I'm sure as I was born, that there are a large number of people saying, oh, Diana wrote this, so it's going to be just like it is in the book. Yes, correct this impression right to start.
Yes. as I recall, when we talked about it on the phone, then I think I started looking at where it might fit in the rotation of the writers and who would have been assigned what and so on. And I'm trying to remember if there was a reason other than that for this particular story. I think it was mostly timing and schedule and where everything fell, right?
Yes, I think it was. For a while to start with, when we spoke, you thought it might be either 208 or 211, and then you gave me 211, for which I thank you profoundly, because I would have had a real problem writing 208.
This is kind of an interesting episode structurally in that it's sort of almost two episodes in one, because you've got this whole, the first half dealing with, you know, the war and then the escape and, you know, running from the redcoats and hiding in the church, and then it sort of shifts gears rather dramatically at almost the 30-minute point and becomes the return of the Duke of Sandringham and, and Mary Hawkins and that whole story.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you've got two interiors separated by this really nice active business in between that turns the story into its different path.
Now, for the reader, for the listeners who don't know the books, how different is this episode from this general section of the novel?
Oh, let's see. There are some notable differences. Because the novel is told through this section entirely in Claire's point of view, she never sees things like what we're seeing here, the Council of the Jacobites. Right. She would hear about it ex post facto, but there would be none of the dialogue that the book readers have ever seen. They only know what the upshot of this part was. The other parts they have seen through Claire's eyes because she was present. So that would be the main thing.
Is this scene with Claire pulling the teeth in the book?
No.
This is not.
No, but because we needed her to be physically present while we were seeing what Jamie was doing inside, she needed something to be doing. Claire being Claire, she's obviously doing something medical. So we get this interesting tooth on a stick scene.
Yeah.
I was impressed by that. The bloody tooth in the pliers is actually glued to the pliers because otherwise Katrina might drop it.
Yeah, she would drop it. I love this little beat with Rupert, too, trying to comfort the kid.
Now that's entirely mine.
Yeah.
They had a whole gallon bottle of O blood sitting on the table next to this lady. It's just out of camera shot.
That's right. We should also mention that, too. You were present during
I was there, like six feet away from most
of this episode, as you recall, right? Because you were there for the block, because we shoot them in blocks of two, and we shot 208 and 211 together for various scheduling reasons and weather or something, as I recall.
Yeah, I think the only important thing I missed was the scenes that were actually in the chapel.
Because
I wasn't there for the night shooting since it was during Thanksgiving week.
So is there no one among you still willing to stand by your prince?
I love this little beat a lot with Charlie asking who's going to stand with him. So how different was it being on the set this time? Because you were on the set briefly season one for maybe 3 days?
Yeah, 3 days.
And this experience was like, okay, now you're here.
you actually have a job.
that was
fun. It was much more interesting and fun than being an actor, at least the sort of actor I was, and that I was basically just standing there. That was fascinating in its own terms.
Oh, when you were...
Yeah, when I did the cameo in episode four. But yeah, being there and being able to see what was going on, you know, in person, from watching the dailies, I had a real good idea of how repetitious and wearing it is, and I was dead right. But just watching the dailies, you don't get the sheer effect of being on your feet for 14 hours a day in the rain and biting wind, wearing six layers of rubberized clothing.
Did you have a chance to talk to many of the cast much?
Yes, I did.
Did they come over and like pick? I always thought they're going to come over and just like pick your brain like constantly because you're there and suddenly you're available and they can ask every question they imagine.
No, really not. It was just chat and so forth. Yeah, during one of the later scenes, which we'll get to, I was standing there talking to, I think, one of the makeup girls, and Graham comes down the hill, and he said, "I just had a conversation with my balls." Both of them said, "We'd really rather you didn't do that again." I said, "I should have worn a cup this morning. I know I should have worn a cup." But what struck me mostly, especially through this earlier part and so forth, was how much things change actually during the filming.
Right.
And they change for all kinds of reasons, mostly logistical, but sometimes behavioral and so forth. For example, in this scene we've just been watching where Jamie moves up the table to take his place behind Charlie with his sword, and very dramatic and all that. There was originally a speech connected with that, which was actually not one of my speeches, but one of the rewrites. Anyway, Sam brought that to me, and he said, "We've just been blocking this. I got to walk up this this table while saying the speech. I'm going to have a lot of speech left over when I get to the end, and it's not going to work. Can we take off these two sentences?" And I had a quick look at it. I said, "We need the first one because it hooks in here, but we'll take out that one. Will that work?" And he said, "Yeah, it'll work." And then, of course, they ended up taking it all out and doing it in silence, which was much more effective.
Right.
But that happens over and over and over again.
It does happen over and over. I mean, it's one of the little skills that I think you pick up in TV and or probably in films too, to a certain extent, is that impromptu kind of moment where they come up and, well, do I need this line and this line and this line? Can I just say that? And you have to instantly kind of like shrink it down to what is necessary.
Do you have to need this?
Do you need to say this? Yes, you do. That doesn't matter.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. And sometimes they'll just come up with something, you know, off the cuff that's just perfect. You're going, yeah, great, let's keep that.
The most frequent thing I hear from an actor is, "Can I just say this with a look? Do I need to say any of this dialogue? Can I just do it with a look?"
Yeah.
And a lot of times the answer is, "Oh, actually, yes, you don't need to say any of that." And then sometimes it's, "No, this is actually a fairly complicated idea.
We need to explain this."
The audience needs to know this. Even it's good that you know it.
Yeah, I was shadowing Anne, essentially, she being the senior partner on this block. In other words, for the benefit of the listeners, she was the boss. She got to rewrite stuff as needed. And, you know, it's very good to work with and so forth. But, you know, we'd run into these little situations. We'd be standing together, and one of us would say, "Do you think this would work?" And the other would say, "Well, that would work, but maybe this would work better." Mm-hmm. And, you know, two or three back passes, and they'd end up doing it with a look. But
It is kind of fun. I do actually, it's sort of, in the moment, you're sort of like, "Oh my God, I have no time to think about this." But in some ways, it's almost better because you do just have to, like, you know, pound it out right there, standing in the mud.
Yeah. Now, this is the only scene that is exactly the way I wrote it.
Is
exactly
it? That's
the way I envisioned it, yeah.
Yes. There was some question about whether we were going to subtitle this. I know that Sam felt like, oh, you don't need to subtitle it. It's just Gaelic. It's, we've done this in season one. And
you totally need to subtitle it.
Yeah, because otherwise I think you lose all the, you definitely lose all the poetry of it and the resonance of it. And it's just now we're inside the characters' heads. And, you know, he's one of our, Jamie's now one of our characters as much as Katrina is in season two. So it felt like you could open the show up and translate what he's doing.
Yeah, exactly so. Yeah, and the bulk of that prayer is taken, it's a real Gaelic prayer.
Is it?
It's taken from the Carmina Gaedelica, which is this fabulous collection of prayers, incantations, and charms that was collected in the 19th century, but which goes all the way back to the 17th. So I've adapted the language a little bit and put in one phrase of my own, but other than that, it is the original Gaelic phrasing, and then Adam translated it, of course.
Oh, I should probably mention we're drinking Glenfiddich 18 today.
Very nice. Very smooth.
Very smooth. Very nice. We're killing this bottle. This bottle has survived many a podcast, and now it's now it is a dead soldier.
This your go-to for podcasts?
There is no go-to. There's like whatever's still left in the kitchen. Since the show started, was there an impression of just the script writing process that you had before it all started that turned out to be very, very different? Or you kind of knew, because you're friends with other screenwriters and television writers.
Yes.
So you knew generally sort of how the process
was. Well, generally speaking, but most of my friends are movie writers, which is somewhat different in that they are actually responsible for the whole script themselves.
Right.
Whereas this way we have an episodic thing that's moving, and it's planned out ahead of time, at least in rough form. You decide what's going to be in content in each episode before you start actually working on it. And all of the writers kind of have a say in what goes into it and what the order is and how we might handle this and all that. And to the best of my knowledge, that's not the case usually with movie stuff. It's the writer and, you know, the producer and director maybe doing that, and to some extent the actors insofar as they have a say.
Yeah, you came into the writer's room and we broke this story.
I did, yeah.
We broke this story together. Was it a one-day break?
Yes, it was.
It was.
Yeah, it took us about 4 hours. So it was pretty quick. But this is one of the nice things about this, and why I'm glad you gave me this particular script, is that the flow of events actually sticks very close to what it is in the book.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to do a lot of structural rearrangement.
Yeah, this wasn't a case where we were moving storylines around and resequencing things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that Gaelic prayer is somewhat out of sequence, and that it actually comes from a scene in Outlander.
Oh, really?
Yes, which you didn't use, so I thought, well, good, I can stick it in here.
That's great.
I just had lunch with Katrina, in fact, and we were talking about scripts and so forth. And I said, bar the obvious bits about it being consensus and collaborative and all that, the most interesting difference between writing script versus writing novel is that when I'm writing novel, you know, it's all me, and so I have to describe how people said things and what their body language was while they were saying it and how is the light falling, and you don't do any of that when you write a script. It's all up to somebody else. You have to leave room for the gaffer and the crew to set the scene, to do the lighting, and you have to leave room for the actors to act. In other words, you can't tell them too much.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought that one of the first things you have to let go of as a screenwriter or a TV writer is letting go of the movie that plays in your head while you're writing it. Because inevitably, if I write a scene and a character comes in from camera right and sits down on a certain line, he will always come in from camera left and he will stand throughout the whole thing.
Yeah.
So you always have to like let go of this idea of the movie that you think you're writing.
Right. Well, in this instance, it had to do, part of the things I let go of were basically things that you took away from me. For instance, the scene with Rupert and Dougal in the chapel and so forth.
Oh,
okay,
right.
You told me I can't do that because you're not going to kill Rupert. You wanted him to be on Culloden Moor with Angus.
Oh, right, because that was all happening. In fact, I think, the first draft had Rupert.
Yeah,
right.
And Angus. Yeah, and then you said, oh, well, we were going to kill Angus at Preston Pans, or we were going to kill Willie at Preston Pans, but now we can't do that because we don't have Willie, so we're going to kill Angus instead.
Right, that's right.
So I lost the scene at the riverbank where I had Rupert and Angus indulging in, you know, knockabout crosstalk act.
Right, that's right.
Yeah, likewise, they had several witty bits in the chapel, which also went the way of the buffalo. I didn't care for what they were replaced with, by the way.
But, you know.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't a big deal.
Come on, Were you there for this sequence when this was shot?
No, I was there for the prep, though, when we picked that site. And there was a lot of discussion. Mike wanted it for the beautiful bridge and the reflections and so forth. But the problem was that we were told that river floods when it rains, and it was about to rain like mad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so he was saying, well, if it's 10 feet higher than it is now, can we still do this? So I wasn't sure until I saw that whether we'd actually be able to use that site. But I was glad it worked. It was a beautiful site and just perfect for that. Originally, we had them in the river fishing when this happened.
That's right, fishing.
Yeah, and there wasn't time for that, but also they couldn't have done it anyway because the water's too high. All works out.
We played around with this sequence a lot in editing.
Yeah.
Because a lot of it just had to do with the physical speed at which we could move the horses out on this location. You know, I mean, you watch a John Ford Western, and those guys can ride those horses really fast. But they were like full-time professional riders that did nothing but do that. And they were out in the desert, out in the big flat, open spaces. And Dom and his crew and his stunt guys did a great job.
They did.
But it's hard to get actors on horses to get the shots and the close-ups and convey speed. So we kept having to rework this sequence so it it felt as fast as we could physically get these horses to go through this forest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was impressive in real life. I was there for this one, standing about 10 feet off the roadway. But I saw them do it a million times. But what was fascinating to me about it was the changing between the stunt riders and the and the actors. Is naming no names, some of the actors can't ride at all.
And they'll tell you so. They're like, I can't really ride this horse.
Yeah, interesting enough. The writing comes in again a later part of the story. But the director was telling me, well, so-and-so, we're going to put him on the mechanical horse. He said, it looks like shit, but it doesn't matter because nobody's going to see it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but what I loved there was the wire rig camera that they had zooming through the trees to follow the chase and all that.
Yeah,
the technical aspects
stuff.
Were terrific, And I was there for the prep of this site, which was really cold while we were there during the daytime. And luckily I missed the night shoots at this location.
Yeah.
I was told they were something special in the way of discomfort.
I think they were brutal. How did you come up? I'm trying to remember how you came up with the Rupert takes the bullet and the eye thing. Was that?
Well, I don't remember. Yeah, I think maybe I said, if I can't kill him, can we wound him?
I think that is what it was.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, that's a great idea. And losing the eye was great because he used to wear the eye patch.
Yeah. No, it was terrific. Nick Hextall-Smith took Ann and me back to makeup when they did the first try at his prosthesis so we could check it out. That was great. And I was like, oh, this is so cool, taking pictures of it. Poor old Grant sitting there going, because it really grossed him out. He couldn't stand to look at
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah. He's just turning white. But he did a wonderful job with it. It was also interesting that this is the Tullibardine Chapel. And, Lord George Murray, the general, his wife and daughter are both buried in the churchyard
there. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Also, the special effects, as in this church does not have a thatched roof, so that's CGI.
Yeah. I remember that discussion. I'm saying, does it have to be a thatched roof?
Well, yes, it does. Yeah, it really does.
It kind of does, actually.
Yeah, I remember one of the props people or location people coming to me and apologizing. He said, with the chapel and so forth, we can't do it the way you have it with the horses because we cannot find a church that will let us take horses inside.
That's right. I remember that.
So that
because that was a key thing. Like the horses were in the church and they were keeping them quiet.
So I had a lot of dialogue connected with the horses and Fergus and so forth.
Right.
And so we lost all that. But after the Redcoats show up, it gets good again.
It's unbelievable that somebody can survive this kind of wound.
Yeah, it's it depends. If it goes in at an angle like that, it's going to stick in the bony orbit. Just right behind you. And so it's not actually life threatening. It's going to destroy your eye, but as long as it's not going straight into your head.
People really made it.
Yeah, they did.
I remember reading in one of the Patrick O'Brien books.
Yeah.
It was a description of the doctor, the surgeon, it was a sailor had taken a skull fracture.
Yeah.
His mm-hmm. brain was swelling, and mm-hmm. he, what was it called?
Trephining, yeah.
Trephining?
Uh-huh.
And it, the description of cutting open his head mm-hmm. and taking mm-hmm. the skull up and exposing the brain and then putting it back on.
Yeah.
I just thought, really? You could do that in the 19th or 18th century and get away with it, and people would actually survive? They wouldn't just die of infection, like, immediately? And
they totally
that's
did.
Remarkable.
Yeah. What's even more remarkable is that there are 3,000-year-old skulls that show trephining holes.
God. It's really
and
amazing.
And healed trephining holes, and they survived too. But yeah, it's one of my favorite scenes from the Aubrey Maturin books too. I'm on my like 18th re-listen of them.
Oh, they're so good. Lay down
your arms. I love this red coat captain.
Oh yeah, he's
great.
Great
voice.
Yeah, you can see their breath in this scene. This was not a pleasant location.
No, it wasn't. No, I was in there. Yeah. A couple of good lines coming up, though, that I like. I'm the one with the price on my head. I'm going to come back and give myself up in exchange for your freedom. Oh, stop being such a hero. That one.
Yeah, stop being such a hero. Was Dougal with them in the book?
Yes.
He was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because originally, yeah, he was the one who had to kill Rupert.
Oh, right. That's what it was. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what was so good about that scene was the emotion between Rupert and his war chief. They will fire the place with me inside. Exchange me. Use me to bargain with them. It worked the last time. With a what? He's a soldier. Never. You're in the charge. If you have an English woman in there. Get up out, hostage! Not likely. We'll run a the clear's right. The soldiers will not hurt the Scottish weapons. Ah, you big Scot. You big obstinate Scot. Just listen to them. Yes, you will, you stubborn Scot. Stubborn Scot. Yeah, now I wrote that line as, yes, you will, you bloody pig-headed Scot. And somebody changed it.
Oh,
I don't
really?
Know if it was Katrina or somebody else. Same intent.
Yeah. Great cinematography in this whole
it
sequence.
Is. Uh-huh.
This is lit mostly by torchlight, by actual torchlight
mm-hmm,
out there.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's got a little bit of a fill going on there in the background, but mm-hmm. for the most part, this is all practical lighting.
Yeah. It's always nice to see Dougal when he's in form, you know, rather than, you know, off his head. They did a really good job with that in the last episode.
Mm-hmm. The widow you encountered along the way, you took her under our protection. Your protection? I know the reputation of Highlands, so I must tell you, if she has been harmed, all agreements are void. I like the sort of reminder of sort of the code of etiquette and honor in the 18th century and how seriously they took it and that they literally would stop things like this and make these agreements and everyone, there was just such an expectation that, well, of course you're going to abide by this.
Yeah, you're a gentleman, of course you're going to do that.
Of course you're
going to
do it.
Yeah, in fact, there's one line in there where Dougal asks specifically for his word of honor, and somebody wanted that put in because they weren't sure that it would be clear from the cultural context to a modern civilization who would be going, well, why would he keep his word?
Yeah, why would he do that?
Oh, because he would.
Do you remember when you're writing like this section of the book or the book in general? Like, I find when I look back at stuff, I have no real memory of when I wrote stuff.
Oh.
So I'll watch it on camera later, even stuff that's recent or stuff that's very long ago. And I sort of don't remember the act of writing it or what it was like. It's all kind of, it's almost like separated from myself. Like, oh, someone else wrote that, or that's, mm-hmm. I don't remember why I would have done that, or where I was when I wrote that piece. It all just becomes very separate from me as I look back.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes and no. I mean, a novel, like I say, it's all mine. Yeah. And it's not changing under me, so to speak. Other people are not taking pieces of it away and right. altering them and so forth. And also, I write really, really slowly, and I reread frequently. So I will have been through a scene hundreds of times by the time it's finished. It's very well fixed in my head. And I remember the sensation of writing this piece, especially if it's a very memorable chunk. Yeah.
You remember kind of where you were and sort of...
Not the physical surroundings, because I'm not ever where that is. I'm in the book, but I remember what it felt like, you know, to see this come to life and feel it and all that. But that said, you do separate from a book after you've finished it. In fact, I told my son, who's a novelist, I said, look, you know, put it aside for before you send it to your editor, put it aside for a month. Come back and read it with a cold eye, and then you'll see anything that needs to be changed.
How much rewriting do you do, typically?
I rewrite while I'm writing.
So in the moment.
Yeah, so I fiddle. I go back and forth and back and forth and change words and move things and so forth and bring in a piece here and so forth. So it's like putting together, you know, it's like playing Tetris in my head, but very slowly.
And when you, after you put it aside for a month and you come back and mm-hmm. read it with a cold eye, have you ever done like a complete page one rewrite, or you find
no.
it's mm-hmm. it's mostly tinkering with little
pieces? It's moving pieces around. It's spotting repetitious passages that should be cut out. It's mostly asking, do I need this line? Do I need this page? Do I need this paragraph? And whacking things out.
But you're never like changing story. It's
no.
pretty much
mm-hmm.
like it's because you worked
no.
it out the first time.
Yeah, well, I don't plan the stories, and I don't write in a straight line. So I'm writing in pieces,
right.
which are building a shape. And once I've seen that shape, you know, then it's set. And the writing gets faster because I can see what's missing. But the shape never changes once I've seen it.
So you write the individual pieces, and then you mm-hmm. go back and you put in, and so then you're writing, you find yourself, you have to write the connecting pieces in between, like, oh,
yeah.
I have these
mm-hmm.
two scenes.
Yeah, I need a bridge, yeah.
Are those tough?
Yes, those are very tedious, yeah. Those are not fun because, you know, it's I can't see it. I'm just having to, you know, logically go from point A to point B.
It's like it's
yeah.
a mechanical piece.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
yeah, it's the riveting and the welding.
Yeah. I dread any scene I have to write where there's chit-chat at a dinner party or at a cocktail party. It's like, oh, and then they're going to chat about something.
Yeah.
And I'm like, stop physically. Like, oh, my God. What are they? What's the
meaning?
It's all meaningless
about,
talk. And
yeah.
if it's meaningless talk, I don't know how to write it. It's like
exactly right.
I'm searching for it to be something, you know?
Yeah. What you need is an actor like Simon Callow who will just totally
oh,
ad-lib
yeah,
chat.
Just, you could write that. Simon ad-lib something here.
Yeah. It is great. Oh, now the lieutenant here, the one who actually carries Claire off and so
mm-hmm.
forth, he was originally a different actor, and they'd hired him on the assumption that he could ride a horse. They said he could. Well, they tried it. He couldn't get on the horse without help, and once on it, he fell off. And they said he turned green and wouldn't get back on. So they said, well, we're going to have to find another lieutenant. So, in fact, Rob Curtis, who now plays the lieutenant, does a wonderful job. He's actually the husband of, I think, one of the costume ladies.
Oh, you're right. Uh-huh. You're right. I do remember. I don't, unfortunately, remember her name, but yeah,
I do kind of remember
that story. Yeah.
Yeah. So, anyway, David was telling us this, and he said, so we had him read, you know, do you guys and girls want to come and look at the read? And we did. And we said, yeah, he looks fine.
Actors all lie on their resumes. They all say
that's
they
what
can,
they all tell
they
me.
They all horseback riding, skiing,
archery yeah.
fencing, just all this stuff. Whatever. Oh yeah, I can do it all. And then
yes,
course,
we'll work naked.
We'll work naked.
Mm-hmm. And if you come down to it, maybe not so much.
Yeah, maybe not so much. Give me that sock.
Well, I kind of understand the mindset, because you know, you need a certain amount of confidence to be an actor in the first place,
yeah.
and that leads you to believe that, you know, whatever happens, you're going to figure it out. And, yeah, they're right more often than not, not invariably. I'm glad you got the broadsheets in there. I'd use the broadsheets kind of extensively as a, you know, kind of a thematic device
mm-hmm.
through the first draft or so, which most of it was too fussy and we didn't need, but I'm glad that one showed up
yeah,
there.
Yeah, it's nice to finally see one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've ever seen broadsheets from the period. I mean, do they yeah. look like what I think they do, sort of early versions of police sketch artists, because they
yeah,
couldn't have been much
yeah.
more than that, right?
No, they
people
were mostly woodblock, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was mostly a description. You seldom got a picture, but for something like this,
yeah.
you would probably want a rendition. At a certain amount of coincidence that we had to have through here to get Hugh Monroe into the story. So it's a coincidence that Claire finds him outside the inn where they take her. But, you know, there's no other way of doing it.
No, we had to sort of condense certain things.
Consequently, I wasn't expecting to use the whole subplot where they hang Hugh Monroe.
I know.
Which is just as well. But without him, you know, poaching on the Duke's grounds and so forth.
Yeah. I love the character of Hugh Monroe. It's such a great backstory. Is it based on someone in particular in history? I know that this was an experience that happened to people, that this was based on, that he was based on? Just sort of your general reading of...
General reading, yeah. I've come across that particular scenario, you know, of a sailor, you know, dragooned by the Muslims, and, you know, and they had very forcible methods of conversion back in the day.
I'd never heard the thing about the
Gaberlunzies.
Gaberlunzies. I'd never even heard of that concept before I read that in the book. The Gaberlunzies are the little medallions that Hugh wears that allows him to beg at particular parishes, right?
That's right, yeah. That was how they regulated their beggars.
And was that only in Scotland?
As far as I know, yeah. Huh. At least that's the only place where you find that term. It's a specifically Scottish term. I don't know if English parishes, you know, had a similar system. I kind of think not, but the Scots are very organized.
It's a very organized thing.
There's actually a Scottish band called Gaberlunzie.
Is there?
This was one of the first locations we scouted. Walking up to the gate and standing there on the grass, and Mike arguing with somebody about how many soldiers we'd need to make it look like the place was surrounded.
That's such a great moment. I love just bringing Simon back into the show. As soon as he walks in the room, you sort of rub your hands together gleefully, like, oh, this is going to be fun. This will be fun. He's just so great. He's such a complete pro. How may I be of assistance? I believe isn't he writing or has written like a multi-volume biography of Orson Welles?
Really? I
believe
no idea.
So. I might be wrong about this, but I think someone was telling me that he's... Yeah,
fascinating.
He's quite a writer, and he either has written or is in the process of writing a bio of Orson Welles.
Wow. Well, I have to look for that.
Yeah.
I exchanged, I think, 2 sentences with him while I was in his presence. Talked up to me and said, oh, so you're responsible for all of this? And I said, well, yes, and here we all are.
Here we are. Funny how that happens.
Now, all of this with the Duke, that was one of the messiest parts of the script, was because we started with the assumption that we wanted this battle of wits between Claire and Sandringham, and so we wrote that, and it was too long, and we rewrote it. I think I rewrote it 3 times, and then you trimmed it some more, and then Anne rewrote it, and then when we finally got to filming, Mike Barker looked at it, and he said, we're not going to have time for this. He said, I've worked with Simon Callow before. He's going to wallow in these speeches. He said, can you cut these to the bone?
This would be an hour right
here. Yeah, exactly. So we retired with Marina, the writer's assistant, put it up on the screen, and we just rammed through it and whacked things out right and left.
These are two characters you could just write endlessly. You could just write on and on and on. Because
they just talk for themselves.
And they're so good together. She has such good chemistry.
An interesting production note that they told me while we were on set was that Simon likes chocolate. And so they're nibbling, you know, throughout various parts of this evening. And he said that he didn't really like what they were serving him for nibbles. Could he have chocolate instead? And they said, well, they didn't really have chocolate in the sense that we mean it now. You know, it was a bitter drink without sugar and not, you know, hard candy and so forth. But the kitchen being enterprising, they made chocolate into the shape of, you know, olives and things like that.
Oh, that's
so
great.
So when you see him eating olives by the handful.
Which is why
we had so much trouble with the moving parts of this plot. With the army, and where were they, and what were they doing, and were they in cahoots with the Duke? Were they actually watching him? And as it is, it turned out to be sort of both.
it turns out to kind of be both. Mm-hmm. I do remember that. It was an endless kind of a wait a minute. It was all about if she thinks this and then, he thinks that, but wait, what's really happening?
Yeah, so we never knew what was really happening.
Yeah, who's tricking who? And what is his game and what's her game to outwit his game? And it was a lot of circular conversations.
It was, yeah. And then we had to deal with Mary Hawkins, too. You know, where does she come into the story?
Where does she come in? What does she think is happening?
Mm-hmm. And can Claire use her, and in what way? And then there was the physical layout of the place, you know?
Yeah, and how that limits then actually how you structure the scenes.
Yes, can she see, people in the garden from her window? And if she can, what does she tell Mary about them? And how is Mary going to find Hugh Monroe if he's wandering around in the grounds?
Oh, God.
Yeah, and can Hugh look in through the kitchen window so Claire can see him?
Can Claire see him when he runs across the grass?
Yeah. I remember a lot of the prep work in this particular house because it was my first exposure to what actually happens when they do that, where you have 40 crew chiefs and a lot of other personnel and the writers and the director and the producer all in there. And you're running through the script saying, well, this is the first scene, what's going to happen here? So Nick, the AD, reads the first, what's going to happen in the first scene. And he says, so we've got two doors in here, and turns to Mike and says, which door do you want to... the Duke to come in through? And Mike looks around and he says, well, I want a fire in that hearth over there, so he'd better come in through the other door. Immediately, three people jump out of the crowd and go to start measuring the fireplace, looking up the chimney, and figuring out where to lay the gas line, because they're using portable gas fires through all of this. And in this particular scene, this is one of my small bits of input, in that Steve McNutt, the DOP, wanted candlelight for this, and it's a stately home. It had huge chandeliers with electric candles, which looked really funky.
Right.
So they're discussing, well, what can we do about this? Can we have electric candles with sleeves so you can't tell, and so forth, and so on. But there's no way we can do that. And Steve's saying, well, I really want candlelight on her face. And I said, well, could somebody, she's got a servant, could the servant, bring in a candlestick and put it down next to her? That way we don't have to get permission ahead of time, and that's my candle.
Oh, there you go. the magic of Hollywood.
There's Mary right on cue.
Such a happy room. My lovely daughter has some exciting news about her. She's to be married.
Right, we hadn't, I forgot about that. We hadn't established that she was his goddaughter back in Paris, which is where it was established in the book, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we theoretically knew that at this point in the book, but it only takes a half sentence to establish it.
I didn't know.
And that was one other little half scene that I was sorry to lose that I'd written, which was that later we have, the way it was written originally, Claire meets... Mary alone, in her bedroom and so forth. And the first thing Mary says is, the baby, because last time she saw Claire, she was hugely pregnant. And I said, she's going to want to know where the baby is. And so Claire says, so bad. And anyway, the way that Mary reacts, that makes Claire say, oh, my God, are you pregnant? And she was, because she could easily have met Alex by then. And Meryl wrote and said, would you mind if we didn't let Mary be pregnant here, because we want her to be pregnant in the next episode? Said, no, not a problem. Yeah, but it is strange that she never asked Claire about the baby.
It is strange. Now she pointed out. right here she was saying, weren't you bigger the last time? I thought it was as big. Is that where babies come from?
Yeah. Now this little bit here was not actually in any of the versions of the script. It was written ex post facto.
This was written much later and shot much later. This was after we put the show together.
Yes, it's a pickup
and watching
piece.
The cut. Yeah, yeah, this was a pickup because we felt like...
You kind of need to show the meeting.
Yeah, because we had skipped over a whole beat here. It was suddenly, structurally the way it was, Claire sends the letter out off camera, and then suddenly you had Hugh Monroe meeting up with Jamie and Murtaugh and say, hey, I've got this messenger met me, and it felt very awkward.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah, no, I agree. This works very well.
Yeah, all of this. This was all of it. I don't remember if Matt Roberts shot this or not.
He may have. It was done way after everything else.
Yeah, this was like months later. But then we get to see Hugh Monroe, man of action. This is when Hugh gets his own spin-off series.
Yeah.
At this point. And then he solves crimes.
Yeah, I love Simon. In or out of costume.
Yeah, he's pretty
really nice guy. But it's a great costume, you know. That's the costume is the character essentially here.
I think it's one of Terry's favorite costumes.
Yeah, I don't blame her. Deborah Lindsay's or not. Oh, and we had an argument with Terry come to the end over this cloak that the Duke is wearing here.
Yeah,
because we had to find a way for the valet's birthmark to be seen by Claire.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'd written it. He comes in, you know, takes off his cloak, hands it to her, which is in fact what's going to happen here. And Terry was, no, I want you to see what he's wearing underneath. Oh. I don't want it to be covered with his cloak.
Right.
And so I said, well, you know, maybe we can have him come in with it over his own arm as though he's been outside and he can just hand it to the valet and so forth. So that's how we left it. But then in the shooting, it worked out. Maybe Simon liked the coat.
Probably.
I don't know.
I don't know how many times we redid that birthmark in post-production, too. We digitally made it bigger, smaller, darker, lighter, trying to get it so it read on camera.
Yeah. Actually, Danton is the only actor who did talk to me about his part.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, mind you, I talk to Sam and Katrina all the time anyway, so if they had concerns, they would have mentioned it. But. Yeah, I don't know who came up with the idea of this being the comp behind the rape plot and so forth, but it works very well.
Yeah, I remember us struggling to try to, as we were rewriting the Paris section and trying to work that through and wanting to tie it to knowing where it was all going and trying to come up with motivations for Sandringham and trying to tie, and then eventually tying it back to the comp. It went through so many iterations of what the motivation was and when Danton came into the picture and what did he think he was doing versus what he was at. It was again one of those
actually
like,
doing, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I've noticed how this works. I've seen it a few times, which is you start out with what seems like a simple question, how do we get from point A to point B? You then get this extremely baroque explosion of ideas and back and forth, and then it eventually shrinks down in half a sentence, and there you go. It's just, you know, the right half sentence. Shot of Simon, you know, he's just suddenly so sinister.
I know, isn't that great?
Proving myself loyal to the crown by turning over red
gem. He's so aware of the camera, too.
Yeah.
He knows exactly where his light is, how it's lighting his features.
Never had the nerve to do it, but I always want to ask an actor, how much time do you actually spend making faces at yourself in the mirror?
In the mirror?
Yeah. I mean, you need to know what your face is doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I do that to some extent, and you know, because people take pictures of me all the time. So.
Yeah, knowing what your good side is, what your bad side is.
Yeah, do not turn three quarters toward anybody when you're taking a picture.
Where was this location? Do you remember
this
where this
is? Yes, I do. It is something house, and it begins with a D. Drum rig.
Is it drum?
Drum rig, yeah.
Oh, drum rig.
Drumland Rig, that's it. Drumland Rig House.
Okay.
It's a great house.
Yeah, this was going to be the first time that you saw you. Or not the very first time, but after the letter,
after
it was going to jump to here. It was just too big.
Yeah, you're right. No.
But, you know, it's one of those things you don't quite see until you watch it.
Yeah,
you're
exactly. You're thinking, wait, something missing here. Well, that's the thing, you know, that's why I can't write by hand anymore. I have to see the words as they will appear in print mm-hmm. before I know whether that looks right or not.
I love this little
piece. This letter.
This little letter. She's, you can't even smell.
Especially Murtaugh's last line.
Yeah.
I had to look that up to be sure it was period, but it is.
Yeah.
She's even misspelled help.
I think that was my line. I think I wrote that. This is one of those tough mm-hmm. things where you're shooting day for night.
Yeah.
And trying, the sky is way too bright, but it's, you know, you're trying to balance it. There's a, mm-hmm. there's just a film and TV convention of what dark looks like.
Yeah.
And you kind of lean into it a little bit, but it's still hard to like take out the hard shadows
yeah.
and
uh-huh.
get it sort of looking plausible.
Yeah. We assume that the moon was bright enough
yeah,
that they could be reading
moon
that letter.
Over there.
Actually, there was. They had these huge lights way up on cranes
yeah.
above them. It was really beautiful. And this scene changed because of the room. That room was the one that Bonnie Prince Charlie actually stayed in when he stayed at this house.
Oh, somebody told me that.
Yeah, and it has a secret door built into the tapestry. And so originally as written, and as when we did the prep, Claire was supposed to be poking at the door with a button hook, and Mary would come knock on the other side and say what's wrong and go and get a key and let her out. But instead we said, it's a secret door. Why doesn't Mary just come in the secret door? And here they come out of the secret door. Think about Drumlanrig House. The reason I couldn't post pictures of it on Facebook or anything is there's this very specific topiary bush in its garden. It's this huge tree, you know, probably 20 feet tall and about 30 feet in circumference. And it looks just like a nipple, you know, with the round breast with this little protrusion
really?
On top. And I was thinking, the minute I post that, everybody's going to know where this is.
That's great. I like to picture the gardener out there sculpting and caring for his giant nipple every day.
Yeah, I really wonder what whoever made it was thinking.
Yeah, what was going on here?
I totally love what they did with the wig through this.
Yeah.
Had all kinds of discussion about where should the wig be. Is
really?
It right next to him? Is it at the end of the table? And that leads into a discussion of what happens later, which was the really messy part of this, going to the logistics. But through here, part of the discussion was the soldier who gets knocked out on the front porch
mm-hmm.
because Mike wanted a shot from outside of him being overpowered and conked and so forth. And Andre, the cameraman, said, can't do it. He said, the camera will not fit on the front porch. These things are like 4 feet long. And he said, I checked from the lawn, it's 20 feet below. You know, I'm not going to see anything if I shoot straight up. So, you know, can't do that. So they had to shoot that from inside the house. And then the question was, well, you know, how are we going to, isn't the Anton going to see this?
Yeah.
And I actually said, can they just pull him out of sight? And we see his feet going out, so that's what they did. Mind you, this is 2 out of several million suggestions that were made during that day.
I remember a lot of discussion with what's Mary wearing on her feet?
Yes, that's what I was going to say.
Terry saying, well, there weren't like slippers, or no,
mm-hmm,
and so
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't know that one was indoor and one was outdoor, so the
mm-hmm.
fact that she's wearing like outdoor shoes wouldn't
Would
mean
not,
anything.
Yeah. Uh-huh. As cold as it was in there, she wouldn't be barefoot. I was in that kitchen, you know, about 10 feet away from this all the
yeah.
time. Yeah. And 40 people were crammed into that end of the kitchen with me. So it was just like constant, you know, jostling to keep out of people's way.
Trying not to trip over the cabling.
Yeah.
I like the growth of Mary Hawkins
yeah.
through these mm-hmm. episodes.
Yeah. Now she's terrific in the next one.
Yeah. She's really good the next one.
Claire's upstairs in the kitchen. Tell Jamie it's a trap. Where are you going? With a mouse?
See?
Yeah, there you go. Drag him away.
The other thing that people don't realize is just how much stuff is shot that doesn't end up.
Tons of stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there was that great beat there that I reluctantly finally cut out where she pretends to faint.
Yeah.
He picks her up, throws her over his shoulder, and as he walked out of the room, he patted her on the ass.
Yeah.
And it was a great beat, and I loved it, but I kept getting this note that it's too funny and it's too humorous and it spoils the mood of the piece. I finally just went, all right. Now, this whole last sequence,
this was ungodly messy.
Oh, my God. I remember they did a rehearsal for us. Remember at the stages at Cumbernauld? Yep. Mm-hmm. They had taped out the room in our rehearsal room, and I came down with you and Anne, and the director and the actors and the stuntmen had all choreographed this action, and they ran the scene a couple of times, and I remember us kind of going, it doesn't quite work. What is Murtaugh? And it was all about, and if Murtaugh's standing there, why would he come here? And it took forever. Ever.
Yeah, and there was all the stuff about, did Jamie keep his weapons?
Yeah, does Jamie have his weapon? And who's,
if he does, why? And
where's which, he? Yeah, couldn't he just jump him if he's standing over there?
And then there's this stuff about, Claire needs to be the one to break free rather than have Jamie rescue her.
Right.
And Sam blesses. So I told Mike Barker, I said, that one doesn't work emotionally because all primates, the male's instinct is to push the woman behind him and go for whatever it is, baboons, gorillas, whatever, they all do that. And the very next day when we ran it again, got to that point, and Mike was saying, now you move back here while Claire does this, and Sam's going, no, I wouldn't do that, I'd just grab her and push her behind me.
She picks that up. She's already thinking about it.
Yeah. Can I? here comes Murtaugh.
Not Little Mary. Little Mary Hawkins?
Hey, if Fergus can do it.
If Fergus can do it.
Now this.
This is.
Yeah. It's one thing I really regret here is that we had it that Murtaugh would, sort of make a Gallic declaration of his heritage, which Adam loved, and Duncan did it in a way it made just the hair stand straight up on your head. But lost that, alas. However, we are left with the head.
We are left with the head. So creepy when you see these prosthetic heads on the set.
Yeah.
Because they look startlingly lifelike.
Yeah, that one sure did. Yeah, and apparently creeped Simon out to the point where he couldn't look at it.
Couldn't look at it.
Yeah, it was very tense shooting that because they had the blood rig on Simon, and they said, it has to work. It's not the scene we can shoot over and over again.
Yeah, because you can't clean up the blood off the costumes, especially.
Yeah, exactly. Good fade out shot.
Nice fade out. Nasty little bit of business to end on. Well, there you have it. It was a fun one.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Thank you so much for doing it. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, no, I enjoyed it a lot.
All right. Well, and to all of you at home, thank you for joining us, and we'll talk again soon for episode 212. Until then, I'm Ron.
I'm Diana.
And good night and good luck.